So we are doing audio recording only. The auto recording, as well as the excuse me, the contents of the chat window and the deck will go up on our website. And now, if I can find the right window, I'll do a mute all. And again, everybody does have the ability to unmute themselves. Please feel free to do so. If you have a comment or a question, please remute yourself afterwards so that we have background noise at a minimum. And we have a pretty good agenda on tonight. Hopefully we'll have some time if people have additional items that they wanted to ask or comment or share or anything like that. But in the interest of time, I'll kick it over to Alan to take us through tonight's deck. Alan, take it away.
Okay, thanks, Chris, and welcome, everyone. And there are a couple of questions already in the chat window, so if people want to use that, we'll certainly take a look later on and see what we've got. Okay, so starting off, we've got a share from our favorite Excel guru.
I'm not sure if I'm an Excel guru or if it's this person, Sella Training is the Excel guru. I came across this, and for anybody who uses Excel, it's a pretty cool video. And so it's this person's or this training company's top 25 Excel 2016 tips and tricks. And I think that virtually everybody who uses Excel could find something useful in amongst these. So if you do use Excel, I highly encourage you to check out that video. And if you do the show more when the video comes up, there are links to an intro to Excel for beginners and more tips that are available. So just a handy thing for anybody who uses Excel.
Okay, thanks, Chris. So maybe Chris isn't the Excel guru after all, but he is the Power Toy guru. So the next
Yes. Yeah, I am a Power Toy guru for sure. Well, I'm an aficionado, and I'm just pasting in the links for this into the chat. There we go. Okay, so yeah, the Power Toys, anybody who has listened to me for any length of time probably knows that I really enjoy them. They're a set of utilities. They're up to, I think it's 12 now, utilities that are available for Windows. They run in Windows 10 and Windows 11, and the list of the available utilities are on the screen there now. If you want a really good overview, very brief overview of each of the tools, what they do and why they might be great for you, check out that PC World article on the Power Toys. Now there's a new Power Toy that just came out called Always on Top. And so it allows you to toggle any window that you can see, and you can do multiple windows, so they will always float over top of any other window that you have active on your screen. So an example might be to have a calculator that is always visible, no matter what you're working on, or have a window with reference materials, say a website or something like that, that will always be visible while you do other things. And once you have the Power Toys installed, all you have to do is hold down Windows Control T, and that is a configurable hotkey, so you can change something else if you want, and that will toggle the current window to be always on top. And you can set multiple windows so that they are always on top. I think the last one you do trumps previous ones that were already flagged as always on top. Next. So say I'm working in a document, and so all of a sudden I want to do a calculation. And so I could run calculator to get a quick calculation done. But then as soon as I click back in my document, the calculator disappears. So if instead, while you're in calculator, you hold down the Win Control T, you see that little blue box that is around the calculator that is flagging that it is now always on top. You also get a sound, and it's a different sound for when you toggle it to be always on top or toggle it off from that state. There's a little bit of different chime that it sounds. And then you can see, even though I toggle back into my document and I'm typing in my document, the calculator stays visible on screen. So really, really handy utility. So to use, if you go to the Power Toys, they are actually in the system tray, and they normally will be visible, but they might be hidden behind the chevron. So if you don't see the Power Toys after you've installed them, click the chevron, you'll get a pop-up where you can select the Power Toy icon. And then it'll bring up the configuration screen where you can configure all dozen of them. Always on top is right near the top. And then you can see there are a number of different options that are available on there, including, and I've got something covering up, so you can enable or disable it. So if you decide you really don't like this, you know, you can just turn it off if you don't like it. It will be on by default. You can customize the shortcut. So you can just click on that pen or pencil icon, and then you can press the keystrokes that you want to be enabling or disabling it. And they have a thing, don't activate when game mode is on. I guess that sort of makes sense, that you don't want to have something accidentally screwing up your games. And then you can customize a little bit about the appearance and the color of the border around the window, how thick that extra border is, and so forth. And then the sound. And as I said, there is a different sound for when it activates and deactivates the always on top. And then if you have some that you just don't want to accidentally toggle to always on top, you can actually exclude them. So that, you know, if it's in the foreground and you happen to hit the hotkey for it, it just won't bring it to being always on top. So how to get it? There's a number of ways that you can actually get the Power Toys. The Power Toys is a single collection of toys. You have to install them all. You can't install just one, but you can deactivate any of those that you want. So if you only want a couple of them, just deactivate the others. So you can get it from the Microsoft Store, and the link is there for that. You can get it from GitHub, which is where they actually keep the code repository for it. And I have the link on where you get that. And you can actually use the Windows Package Manager as well. So if anybody read the article on in the newsletter on using the Package Manager, that's something else that you can actually do it. So within PowerShell, you just type in winget install microsoft.powertoys --source --winget, and it'll install it for you. So very, very nice set of utilities. I use several of them. You know, image resizer, the Power Toys run, the mouse utilities, and the other one? Fancy Zones are the ones that I use really ongoing. And now Always on Top, I use it an awful lot as well. So that's it for Power Toys.
Yeah, Tristan just posted that Fancy Zones is a nice feature.
Yeah. And Tristan is the one who wrote the article for the newsletter on using the Windows Package Manager.
What does Power Toys Run do?
When you activate it, it comes up with a dialog box where you can type in something that you want to run on your computer. It's been expanded. It can actually do searches from there now as well. But it'll find all installed programs on your computer and try it out. It's kind of neat, the way that it actually works to find things on your computer.
Yeah, I find Color Picker is a really neat little utility too, where you can basically point at the screen and find the hex code for the color that you're looking at.
Yeah. Anybody who's trying to match colors on things, it's a really superb utility. And it not only gives you the hex codes, it'll also give you RGB values and I think the web codes for colors. So there's a number of different color schemes that you can actually pick up from there.
Does it work for UHD displays?
UHD.
16 bits per color.
I'm not sure, actually, what it would do on that. Yeah, so, don't know.
Justin wants to know if there's a space before winget. It looks as though there is on the slide.
Oh, no, there isn't. It's just, that's just the bullet on the thing. So, yeah, it's just, it's a command line. You just start it with winget and go on from there. I find it actually like either the Microsoft Store or GitHub is a really easy way to install them. But, you know, if you do the package manager, you know, basically you have to go into PowerShell. You have to type out the line or script it or something like that. But the simplest really is the Microsoft Store. So you just go there and say install, and it's done.
Okay. Thanks very much, Chris. And moving along to a couple of Android apps from our friend Tom. Are you muted?
Hello.
No, no, there we go. Tom, you're muted. No, now you're okay.
Yeah, I just wanted to. Okay. Yeah, this is. There's a couple of ones that I'm using all the time. That's my predilection, anyway. If you really want to know what time it is, to within a millisecond or two, this may be overkill for many people, and especially if you're retired like I am, it is really overkill. But the system clock from your mobile network is often 0 to 2 seconds off, and I suppose it could be more, but that's about all I've seen. But with this particular app, you can set your system clock to be accurate within milliseconds. You can specify what time server you want to use, and there's a couple inside this city, so that minimizes the delay of back and forth. The network time protocol actually measures the delay between your computer and the time server, and it goes back and forth until it actually minimizes the error in your clock. An atomic clock will actually show the exact time. You can also get, if you just have a phone, you can just phone the NRC by phoning 613-745-1576, and that's been the phone number for the time for the last 70 years or so. So it's, it's something you can, as another alternative, or if you have a shortwave radio, if you see in portrait gallery, then you can find it at several places on the shortwave bands. And the U.S. also has time signals that it puts out that radio amateurs are quite familiar with. Next. So here's an example of the display. You can if you can have a display like there is on the left. This one, if you pay for it, you can get rid of the ad at the top. But it will tell you the time, the date, and the time exactly to a tenth of a second. I think you can specify more decimal places, but I figure a tenth of a second is good enough for me. Here I have the time server. I left it at the default for this example, pool.ntp.org, but I have since changed it to time.nrc.ca. And it tells, as it says here at the bottom, the system clock is about 1.5 seconds behind the real time. In fact, I also keep my watches quite accurate, and this was then about 10 or 15 years ago. I went into the CTV studios for some reason on some kind of tour or invite, or maybe I was talking, I forget. And I found that their programs were coming up about 4 seconds late, and I mentioned it to the operator there in front of all those screens. And he said, "Oh yeah, we're a little late now. How do you know that? How do you know we're late?" But I had my watch synchronized accurately. On the home screen, you can have a widget that has the time here on the right side, 16 January 2002 03:06. So you can have that displayed. So I use that all the time, and I like to have it down here, especially since with your screen is darker towards the bottom, and the white type looks nicer at the bottom than it does at the top, like you have it in most Android displays. Any questions?
Another slide on the clock.
Okay, so exact times are based on network time protocol servers from atomic clocks. You can find more information about it here. You can choose on the full screen display between an analog and a digital clock. I use the analog. And you can choose different time servers. It's a customizable widget. Time and date is resizable. You can get acoustic ticking if desired, and you can just have it happen just before the hour if you want. So if you want it to go tick, 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 ah, you will have the exact hour. So that may be useful for reminding you to turn on the news or something. You can also choose between different clock faces. I used the default. And you can switch between local time, UTC, and a 24 or 12 hour clock. Any questions?
Timothy said, not a question, just a comment. Live TV shows have a 7 second delay, a delay to air to catch the bad words that might slip in.
Yeah, they have that on radio shows as well, so they can bleep it out or blank it out. Okay, the next one is Lucid Daydream Screensaver. And this starts automatically when you put your device in the dock or when you charge it. And I think you can choose which ones. This Android has a variety of screensavers you can set to start. And this is just one of them. You can also have photos and a variety that Android provides. But this is an actual app. The link is at the bottom of the page. And it shows the current time and date, the battery level, and more. And you can set it in the settings display advanced screensaver. The main advantages of the Daydream screensaver is that it shows the state of charge. It's usually white on black. You may be able to change the color, I don't know. Maybe red would be nicer at night. And it wanders around AMOLED screens to avoid burn-in. AMOLED screens, like the old CRTs of yesteryear, tend to burn in if there's an image on them for too long. In fact, you'll notice that there's, if you get an AMOLED TV, if you have the spare several thousand dollars for it, there's usually a setting that you can avoid burn-in of particular things, of images. And it does not use much power or heat on AMOLED screens, so you can charge it up without only losing a few milliamperes, not very much, because the AMOLED screens only light up the particular pixels involved. Are there any questions?
Does the screensaver kick in normally on a phone when the real display times out?
It will if it's plugged in. It won't if it's not charging.
Oh, so it's only if your phone is on charge you actually use it.
Yeah, and that's why the reason I use it is so that I can, if you want to preserve the length of your lithium batteries, you should keep the state of charge between 20 and 70%. And so I don't let it charge up too much. I usually stop at around 63 or 65%. And having the state of charge showing on the screen lets me see the state of charge without having to open anything.
Okay, well, thanks very much, Tom. Very interesting apps for Android devices. Okay, so the next segment is my series on possibly abandoning the Windows ship and moving to Linux. And we're in the process of looking at all the Windows software that I use and whether we can find alternatives in the Linux world. And if you recall, we ran into two programs, the Taxman, which is a Access database runtime version, which doesn't install in Linux under Wine. And we talked about some alternatives, basically web-based systems, which clearly you can use in a browser on Linux. But the real stumbling block has been this crash data retrieval system, which I talked about last week at length and pointed out that it's a proprietary system. It's very specialized, and there's no Linux version. And it doesn't install on Linux using Wine. So there's a problem. But I have two ways around that. The question is whether it's kind of cheating or not. And Tristan alluded to it in the chat last week. And one of the ways to do it is to run a virtual machine. And I've talked about this previously in probably members' favorites or something. I've been using VirtualBox to create a virtual machine, a virtual Windows machine essentially, using my Linux installation as the host operating system. So this is what I really want to do. And first of all, I have to install VirtualBox on my Linux machine, and then it acts as the host. Then I create a virtual machine using Windows 10, and they call that the guest machine. And then to do that, you have to have a legitimate copy of Windows. So you have to install Windows from something, and I use an ISO file on a bootable USB stick. So install Windows as a virtual machine. And then because I want to create a shared folder, a shared folder on my Linux box that I can share in this Windows machine, I need to install the guest editions option for VirtualBox. But once I've got VirtualBox installed and Windows running and got my guest editions added in, then I can create the shared folder on the Linux side and create the share on the Windows guest machine, on the virtual machine. So now I've got a way of swapping files between Linux and Windows. So now I just copy the Windows executables to the shared folder, install them on the Windows virtual machine, and now I can run my applications on Windows in the virtual machine, basically on Linux. So it's kind of you have to get your head around what's really going on. It's probably easier to think about it when we see the pretty pictures. We talked quite a bit about the software manager in Linux, and sure enough, VirtualBox is one of the applications that you can install directly from the software manager. So basically just searching for it and then pressing the install button and then following all the prompts will basically install VirtualBox on Linux. So here's VirtualBox running. And basically what we have to do, we have to create a new machine, a new virtual machine. So we hit the new icon here, and it basically asks us, well, what kind of machine do you want? So now you specify you want a Windows 10 machine, and you follow the prompts, and it basically asks you how much memory do you want to use, what kind of hard drive, how big is it going to be, questions like that. So essentially, effectively, you create this virtual machine with some video memory and a virtual Windows disk, hard drive essentially, and that's where we're going to do the installation. So now we've got the machine. This is just setting up the virtual machine in VirtualBox. Now what we do is we start that machine, and because there's no operating system, it will ask us, well, how do you want to install it? So here's my USB stick with a whole bunch of different operating systems. And down the bottom here is the Windows ISO, the installation software. So I basically select that, and again, follow all the prompts. It's just follow the bouncing ball, essentially. And once you run out of things to do, it's just a typical Windows installation now. You follow all the Windows install prompts, and then it comes up in a window. And here, the green is my Linux Mint operating system, and the blue window is VirtualBox running Windows 10. So this is a Windows machine now running inside Linux. So if you recall, I need on my Linux system to set up a folder. So I set up this folder called VBox Share, and I've got the Taxman installation executable, and I've also got the CDR software executable plus the authorization file that I need to basically validate my application. in this particular program. So there they are, sitting, the two installation programs are sitting on my shared folder on my Linux box. So if I have installed the guest editions CD from the devices option in the virtual machine, I can now go to machine and settings, and that brings up this Windows 10 settings window. I go to shared folders, and I basically set up a path to the share and tell it that I want this to be drive Z. So Windows is going to think of the Linux VBox share folder as a Windows drive Z. I'm going to have it auto mount. So every time I run the virtual machine, this folder will be mounted as drive Z, and I make it permanent and not read only. So that means I can, by having it not read only, it means I can also write files to this folder in Windows and then have them available on both operating systems. So now I've got my shared folder in Linux. I've got it tied into drive Z for Windows. And if we go and look on the File Explorer in Windows, this is in the virtual machine now, we can see that in the network locations, we set up a share, VBox share as the folder, and it's set up to be drive Z. So now I can go to Windows and basically install those two programs from the shared folder. Remember, they're executables, so it's just a question of double-clicking on the executable, and it will install in Windows and produce an icon on the screen. So now you can see I've got my two Renegade Windows programs available to run in the virtual machine. So if I do that, if I run Taxman, you can see here's a sample of a form from the T1 general form where a single parent is putting in their income. So you can see that program is running. And here is my CDR software looking at an EDR file. And you remember I talked about this a little bit last week. This is the change in velocity that this vehicle is seeing. So it's going from, it's actually fairly minor, about 15 kilometers per hour change in velocity here, and over about 160 milliseconds, which is pretty soft pulse. One of the things I didn't say about event data recorders and airbag control modules and all that good stuff, the reason that you have a computer monitoring the acceleration of the vehicle and trying to decide whether to fire the airbag or not is because you notice that the airbag actually fires. This is a deployment for the airbag. It fires in about, 48 milliseconds, which is way before the end of the pulse. The pulse is still going at around about 160. So the airbag control module is predicting what kind of crash it's going to see and deciding, is this crash of a type and of a severity where I need to fire the airbag? And as I said last week, the thing about things like airbags and lane keeping assist systems and preemptive braking strategies, if we didn't have an electronic record of what the vehicle had seen and what it had decided to do, then we would never know actually how the systems are working. So this kind of electronic recording of vehicle safety data is absolutely critical in terms of developing these systems. Anyway, so that's why I use this particular program and why I need it to run. Because it doesn't run directly on Linux, I have to kind of budget and run it in a virtual machine in Windows, which really is cheating. Because if you think about it, you recall, I have to have an authentic copy of Windows to load as a virtual machine. So I really am running Windows, even though I'm kind of running it through the back door on a Linux box. However, there's another thing I can do, which is still cheating, but it actually doesn't require any work on my part, because my second option is basically do nothing, because all of my computers are actually dual booted. And here's the boot screen when I fire the machine up, when I power the machine up, and by default, it will run Linux. But it has a countdown time of 10 seconds, and if I want, I can select it to boot into Windows. So if I wanted to run the CDR program, I don't actually have to create a virtual machine. I can just switch to the Windows dual boot and literally run it in Windows on a Windows computer. And that's okay, because even when Windows 10 disappears in 2025, it won't have any support anymore. I don't really care, because I can disconnect my Windows box from the internet, and the two programs I'm using don't need internet access to run. I can run them completely locally. So by having the ability to copy files from one machine to the other, I could keep them updated by using new versions when they're available. But I can actually run the programs directly in Windows, even though I spend most of my time in Linux. So there you have it. I'm now going to put a couple of ticks next to Taxman, because as far as I'm concerned, I can still keep running that even when Windows 10 goes away. And similarly, I can run the crash data retrieval system on my machine too. So I really have no issues. So as far as I'm concerned, my machine won't update to Windows 11. Windows 10 will run out of patches, security additions, and I think at the end of 2025, so still got a number of years before I have to worry about that. But if the worst comes to the worst and Windows 10 does go away and I can't go to Windows 11, then I can run Linux quite happily and just poke into Windows every now and again when I need to. Okay. So moving along, Chris has another share, and this time it's on QR codes.
Yeah, I came across this and I thought it was an interesting one, because it's something that I think a lot of people could actually fall for. And so this is the city of Austin was actually warning people that somebody was putting QR codes on their parking meters that would take you to somewhere other than the city of Austin to pay for your parking. Or it could do other nefarious things. And, you know, I thought a little bit about it, and I don't know that we have QR codes on any of our parking meters in Ottawa, but if you were to go and you park somewhere and you're fishing around in your pocket for money to put into it or your credit card, and all of a sudden you see a QR code there that says, hey, scan the QR code and you can pay for this online. A lot of people might actually go for it. It's kind of something that's a little bit hard to validate whether this is legitimate or not, especially if the city you happen to be in legitimately uses QR codes to do the payments for the parking meters. Do you know if the QR code has been covered up with some other QR code that takes you somewhere else? And so scanning the QR code typically just takes you to a website. And so you go there, and if you trust the website, then you may put in some personal information, credit card number, and things like that. You have to think about who created that QR code. Do you have any way of validating, you know, who put that QR code on that parking meter? So I thought it was an interesting scam that a lot of people might quite easily fall for. So next slide.
Wait a sec. In the past, QR codes have been actually even more dangerous, because they could actually instruct your phone to self-destruct in various ways, to lose all the contacts or other things like that. So I'm not sure. I think that's probably been mitigated, but don't trust them.
Yeah, QR codes can be used for a lot of things, actually. You're just going to a website is just one of the things a QR code can do. So what can you do actually about this? And so back in September 15th, at Q&A, we had a QR scanner tip. So rather than just using, you know, any old QR code scanner on your phone, you can actually use one that will actually try to, you know, determine whether this is a known malicious QR code that you're going to or something like that. One of the ones that is there is Sophos Intercept X for mobile, which is a free app available in the Google Play Store. And you load it, and it will try to determine whether, you know, a QR code is going to take you to a known malicious site. So next. So it is not a panacea because, for one thing, it could be brand new malicious site that just got set up that day that the people who run Sophos Intercept X for mobile may not have come across yet. So there's entirely possibility that you will still get malicious codes on your QR code. And as Tom says, probably the best thing to do is not scan QR codes that are out there that you don't validate somehow that it's actually legitimate. But if you are going to scan them, well, maybe this is better than nothing. So the URL is there on, and I'll paste this into the chat window. Oh, sorry. I have something else on my clipboard right now. I will paste that in so it'll be there. So just a thought that people should think about, you know, the idea behind QR codes that they can be malicious. And this is the best that I know of to protect yourself. But if anybody else has any other ideas of ways that you could somehow validate QR codes, by all means, chime in, and you know, maybe we'll get some other ideas bounced around as to what you can do to protect yourself. Anybody have any ideas?
By the way, this also applies to Bitly and other shorteners. You don't know what's behind them unless you're set up, for example, with uBlock Origin or something that does not allow it. It will then prompt you if you want to go to this particular website. So watch out for shorteners as well.
Yeah, there was an article I think I wrote. I think it was in the last newsletter or one of the recent newsletters on a website that will actually expand out dozens of different URL shortening, shortened URLs, and tell you the site that it goes to, as well as it'll do things like the Web of Trust and so forth to say whether it thinks that those are malicious destinations or not. So check that out in the newsletter if you are using shortened URLs. Okay, well, I don't hear anybody else, so if anybody else has anything before the end of tonight's Q&A, by all means, jump in.
I think Tom has put a couple of articles, links to articles in the chat window, so people can look at those.
Yep.
Okay, so moving along, and Bob Walker has another segment in his Privacy Online series, and tonight he's going to talk about different search engines. Bob?
Okay, so I've unmuted myself before I shared my screen, so shouldn't have the problems we had last time. So,
Bob, if your URLs are still on your clipboard, you might want to paste them in again to the chat window as well.
Okay, I'll do that once we get to the end of the presentation here.
Okay.
So, let me just where are we here? There we go. Okay, you're seeing the presentation full screen there?
Yes, we do.
Okay, excellent. Okay, so so far on this mini-series on privacy on the Internet, we've covered VPNs, and we've looked at browsers, And tonight we're going to cover search engines. Now, I don't want to be alarmist in all this stuff, so just keep in mind that your desire or need for privacy on the internet is up to you and your tolerance for having others more know more about you than you might like. So I've been a customer of Amazon since their little wee website down in the States just selling books. So I figure there's not much more they can find out about me they don't already know. So last session we looked at browsers. This week we'll look at search engines and how they can affect your privacy. And like all the other presentations so far, I'll be covering just the tip of the iceberg and pointing you towards where you can go for more information on this. The items you enter into a search engine can disclose highly personal information about you, and these can be things like your medical conditions, your employment status, financial information, your political beliefs, and other private details. This data can be collected, stored, and linked to detailed digital profiles, which contain your real identity. So it's hard to really cover up things because they can piece all this stuff together. The only way you can ensure your data is safe is to keep it out of the hands of the data collectors, of which Google and Amazon are two of the prime offenders. And one of the ways you can do this is to use a private search engine. So if you're concerned about Google, Bing, and other search engines tracking your searches, there are alternatives. Now, some of these private search engines are actual real search engines in that they actually crawl the websites to glean the information they need to deliver search results. These offer more privacy because they don't interact with Google or Bing. But on the other hand, they may not offer the best results that you, the kind of things you expect when you're using Google or Bing. Others are what are known as meta search engines, and essentially they act as a middleman between you, the user, and Google or the other sites, enabling them to offer a better overall experience. And then a few of the others blend both and utilize their own crawlers as well as pulling results from Google and Bing. Now, DuckDuckGo, they're the most popular privacy search engine, and it's the default search engine in the Tor browser, which we covered last week as being probably the most secure browser. The company's name is a reference to a children's game called DuckDuckGoose, and if you download this deck afterwards, you can click on this DuckDuckGoose, and it'll take you to the Wikipedia page. I won't try and explain the game to you because I don't quite understand it myself. They have their own web crawler called DuckDuckBot, but they also pull information from over 400 other sources, and these can include Bing, Oath, and that was previously called Yahoo, and Wikipedia. DuckDuckGo does save your searches, though, but they're not tied to an individual user. So in their own words, they say, we also save searches, but again, not in a personally identifiable way, as we do not store IP addresses or unique user agent strings. We use aggregate non-personal search data to improve things like misspellings. So they do save your searches to a certain extent. They also display ads for affiliate sites in the right sidebar. This is a little bit better than Google, because if you've done a lot of Google searches, you realize that quite often the first one, two, or up to six search results are actually advertisements and not actual search results. So at least DuckDuckGo separates it in a way that's obvious. DuckDuckGo earns additional profits from commissions from sites like Amazon and eBay. And so you might want to be a bit wary if Amazon and eBay results pop up a lot in your search results. And in their own words, it's similarly, we may add an affiliate code to some e-commerce sites, e.g. Amazon and eBay, that results in small commissions being paid back to DuckDuckGo when you make purchases at those sites. So everybody has to make a buck somehow. DuckDuckGo also uses your IP address to serve us up the local results. So they find out where approximately where you're at. And so if you're searching particular things, they can show you results that might be more meaningful to you. So even though it doesn't store your IP address, it's visible to the insight when you do your search request. If you'd rather not have your IP address used at all, you have pretty much two choices. You can use another one of the private search engines that doesn't use your IP address, or you can use a VPN or a privacy-oriented browser like one of the ones we covered last week or last session that disguises your IP address. DuckDuckGo has a feature which allows you to use Google search engine through DuckDuckGo, and you do that by prepending your search criteria with exclamation mark Google, or that's known as bang Google, to searches. However, if you use this feature, well, DuckDuckGo is supposed to partially launder your search. It may not isolate your identity as much as you'd like when you're searching using Google. So this is one of those buyer beware things. Out of four reviews I saw of DuckDuckGo, only one of them mentioned that this was a sort of a security hole, but you may want to keep this in mind. Okay. Now, according to Comparatech.com, they say that DuckDuckGo, overall, this is the best privacy search engine in terms of user experience, especially if you're interested in local search results. DuckDuckGo's interface is very similar to Google, so it's quite easy to use. You can search the entire web like Google, or you can refine your searches to images, videos, news, maps, meanings, or shopping. And you can also filter out adult content, and you can set the time frames of the results so you get the most recent results first. Now, DuckDuckGo is accessible via your browser by going there directly, but it also has apps for iOS and Android, and they have an extension for the Edge browser. Metager, they're based in Germany, and it's operated by a nonprofit organization. Now, in all the different search engines we're going to look at, I've pointed out where they're based in, because those based in the European Union, European Union has very stringent privacy laws as compared to most of the rest of the world, so that could affect some of the results you get. Metager provides results in English, German, and Spanish. And they have their own web crawlers and indexers. But it's primarily a meta search engine. And although they query up to 50 other search engines, Yahoo and Bing are their biggest, and their best results come from going through Bing. Metager also has an Onion site that can be accessed through the Tor network. And the Onion sites are a special use top-level domain that the Tor network has that designates an anonymous Onion service. Keep in mind that Tor stands for the Onion router. So these are formerly known as hidden services, but now they're called anonymous services. Now, most of the search engines, when they decide what results to display first, look at click-throughs through a website as one of the ranking factors. Metager doesn't do this so much because they want to serve you a variety of results. So you might not get quite the results you're expecting. Their business model involves donations, membership fees, and non-targeted advertising on the results pages. So They do store your IP address for up to 96 hours because they limit the number of searches from a particular IP address in a given amount of time, and they need a way to track this. So they all have their ways of monetizing the searches. Because they have online advertising, this is non-targeted, not, you know, in a way that Google isn't. And so they do need to collect some data. And they do provide their advertisers with what they call truncated IP addresses. These are supposed to give your approximate location data and user agent details, including what browser you're using and the operating system you're using. But according to Metagirl, none of this information can supposedly identify you as a particular user. Okay. Chris, have you seen the top paragraph there all messed up?
Yeah, but it's readable.
Okay. So Metagirl adds an extra layer of privacy by giving you the option to open up a web page anonymously. So you open up the web page by clicking through on the results, and this is supposed to provide a layer of privacy between the website and you. Their user interface isn't as result refined as a lot of the others, but it's fairly easy to use. You don't have as many search options as with some of the other platforms, but you can search the entire web or only pictures or only shopping. And they also allow you to filter the results by date or language, or you can filter out the adult content. There's a Metagirl Firefox add-on extension, and you can set Metagirl as your default search engine for Chrome or Edge. You can also download an Android version of Metagirl as a native app. Now, Quant, Metagirl and Quant are both based in the European Union. Quant delivers results in the choice of more than a dozen languages, so it's probably one of the more multilingual of the private search engines. They don't track you or your devices, and they promise not to log your search history. And in their own words, is we don't use any tracking device, including pixels or fingerprinting, and we don't collect and we don't store any history of your searches. This is a meta search engine that primarily takes Bing search results and delivers them to the user. They do have their own indexing capabilities as well, but a lot of these private search engines seem to use Bing as their main search engine that they deal with. So with Quant, their profit model includes affiliate deals with sites like eBay and TripAdvisor. So for some of your searches, you may end up with these sites having an unfair advantage in terms of making it to the top of the results pages. Most of the test searches that were delivered based on the three sites I looked at on rating these sites, delivered the expected results, but any type of local search results were generally inappropriate. So because they don't really use your IP address, they can't deliver the local search results you might expect. Quant has extensions for Chrome and Firefox, and apps are available for iOS and Android. If you need a faster, lighter search engine, for example, if you're using an older version of a web browser, Quant Lite is a designed specifically for that. Another private search engine is Mojit, and they're based in the UK. Now, unlike the other tools we've covered so far, they exclusively use their own crawlers and don't rely on any of the mainstream search engines for the results. This makes it more suitable for users who are trying to avoid companies like Google and Bing altogether. Because as much as other sites try and keep a layer between Google and Bing and you, it's not always 100%. The downside is that your search results won't be as refined as those you get from the big search engines, since they can't quite contend with the quality of search for the big search engines, because they've only been around a little while. Another one that I wanted to cover was Swiss Cows, partly because their logo there is sort of interesting. They're based in Switzerland, which is not part of the European Union, so they don't have the same privacy laws that govern their product. But they do a very good job with privacy and security. They promise that they don't track your searches and they don't do data collection. So they're one of the top privacy search choices. In testing with the various outfits that did the testing, it provided good search results. And again, they do their searches primarily through Bing. Because Swiss Cows doesn't pass on user data from search requests, they're unable to effectively monetize their search through ad partners, which means that they largely rely on donations and sponsorships to maintain their operations. And as a result, sponsors can get a banner ad at the top of the results, or they can get other ads on your results site. However, one really unique aspect of Swiss Cows is that they're very passionate about family-friendly content. As they explain in their about page, is we promote moral values, we hate violence and pornography, we promote digital media education, and so while some people might like the fact that Swiss Cows filters out adult content, others may see this as a great feature, especially if their computer is used mostly by their kids. That's pretty much what we got to talk to tonight. I've got a couple of URLs here, and I'll paste those back into the chat window. Two great articles here on the various privacy search engines, and both of the articles list several search engines I didn't cover tonight. I tried to cover the main ones, so let me go. End the share here, and I'll see if I can get the results pasted in.
Bob, it's Lawrence. I have a question if you're able.
Okay.
The question, or the, did I read and hear properly that the sites that you mentioned that protect privacy depend on Bing for their search results?
Some of them do, yeah. Yeah, the main one that doesn't is Mojit, but most of the others, even if they do have their own web crawlers, tend to put a lot of the results through Bing.
Okay. Well, I'm from my perspective, if I want to do any effective searching, and I don't know what others feel about this, but so this will be the chance to speak up, is that Bing isn't worth a darn as far as Google, as searching. And yes, I realize that means I'm dependent on the devil, being Google, for accurate search results, even when it comes to dealing with Microsoft issues. I don't know if it's still the issue, but for years now, I gave up on Bing for looking up Microsoft-related issues because, again, it did not perform, whereas Google did. So, what's that worth, especially if you're concerned about privacy?
I use DuckDuckGo all the time as my default search engine, and I set it up as my default in Firefox, and I think my other browsers too. And I find it's reasonably useful. If I can't find it on DuckDuckGo, then I go to Google. It gives me a lot more choices to tailor my particular search. But DuckDuckGo does a pretty good job in my experience. It handles 95 to 98% of my searches.
Yeah, when I want to do a fairly accurate search, I generally go to Google. Otherwise, I use DuckDuckGo. And I agree with Lawrence that the times I have used Bing as a search engine, the results have been less than spectacular. But it seems to be the default, you know, most of these private search engines that use other sites will go to a variety of sites. And then some of them you can decide which sites you want them to go to. But it seems their default, if they're going to go to a particular site, seems to be Bing. And I suspect that the reason they do that is because Google has more tools for drilling through the firewalls or the privacy walls there to still tell who the hell you are and to track your searches even through a private search engine, whereas Bing doesn't have that level of sophistication. So,
question just came in, Bob, and I wonder if engines that resort to crawlers take longer to return results.
Pardon?
I imagine the crawlers cache their results, right?
To a certain extent, but from what I understand and all the research I've done, is any caching of results are done in the big picture sense and not in a way that can identify you. Now that said, before I retired from the Public Health Agency of Canada, we collect a lot of health data, and we're very strict on making sure the data that's stored in our databases is anonymized, so it can't identify. You know, even though we want to track, you know, case by case, we make sure it's anonymized to the point that any researchers using that data can't identify particular cases. But I had a team working for me that did data analysis, and one of my people was particularly adept at taking pretty scant anonymized results and drilling it down to a particular person. So that's the sort of thing that Google likes to do is match what few little pieces come through from the private search engines and tie it together with their other information to identify who you are and what you're doing. So.
Okay, well, thanks, Bob, and we look forward to more information next week, I guess.
Yeah,
also, thank you.
Yeah, I've pasted the two URLs that I got most of the information from into the chat window there again. So,
also, don't forget that both Chrome and Edge probably are looking at what URLs you're actually putting in to go to. And the same thing for any antivirus you have that's checking the websites you're going to. They obviously have to have those URLs to be able to check the reputation of those websites. So it's very hard to be very private unless you're using Tor.
Yeah, well, next week's session we'll be looking at the different ways that the websites track you. So we'll be covering some of this, how they can identify you in several different ways.
Okay, thanks. So we're a few minutes over. There were three questions in the chat window. I'll just post them up here right now. I don't think we're going to have time to go in any detail here. Basically, Micheline's looking for a small form factor desktop computer as a replacement. V was looking for a free scanning program for an HP scanner. And there was a question about whether AMOLED was the same as OLED and do OLED screens burn in. So if anybody wants to answer those questions, you can send us the answers to suggestion box and we'll do them as follow-ups next week.
Just before we move on, E. O'Driscoll just commented something about the Linux Windows 10 presentation. Do you want to address that right now, or?
Sorry, what was the question?
It's do I understand correctly that apart from the fact that you liked Linux, the advantage of putting Windows 10 as a virtual machine on Linux is that after 2025, when no patches are coming, you can still use Windows 10 without worry. Is that part of what you were saying?
Well, kind of, except really what I was saying was if you disconnect Windows 10 from the internet, then you really have no security issues because you're working with whatever you had when you shut the thing down.
And I think, so, in a way, the larger point on that, too, is that you would love to have had an alternative to Taxman that was a native Linux app, and you would love to have a native Linux app for your crash data recorder, but they are simply not available.
Correct. So if I want to keep running them, I have to run them in some form of Windows.
Yeah.
If I don't have access to Windows 11, then I'll have to keep using Windows 10. But I think I can do that securely because I can just do it locally on my computer, completely separate from any internet connection.
Yeah, and possibly a further thing on having a legitimate copy of Windows, you can actually run Windows for, I forget if it's 30 or 60 days, fully functional without having a license key. So it is possible to run, it's legitimate Windows, but it'll only operate full functionality for a limited period of time. So if you don't have a license key for Windows, you could still get around it a little bit that way.
If the virtual box is good enough, maybe you could run Windows 11 inside it, even if your hardware doesn't particularly have the things that Windows 11 wants.
Or I could just use the Windows 10 that I've got.
Yeah.
Works for me. Okay, well, if anybody can answer those questions, next week we'll follow up on those. And in the meantime, I'll just remind everybody that we have our 2-for-1 membership special. If you're not a member, if you join now, you'll essentially get 2 years membership for the 1 year $20 fee. And final thing for tonight, our next Q&A will be next Wednesday, January 26th. As usual, if you have questions, or you can answer those questions I just posted, or topics that you'd like to share that Chris hasn't thought of yet, send us a heads up to suggestionbox@opcug.ca. So I hope everybody found that interesting. We had a lot of different material again tonight. So thanks for attending, and hopefully we'll see you all next week.
Thanks for coming, folks.
Bye-bye. Thank you.
Good night, everybody.